Welcome to the Oscars edition of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies with me, Lisa Schmeiser, and my co-host, Philip Michaels.
I'm here in my tux. I look fabulous.
It's true, he does.
I'm wearing.
Who are you wearing tonight?
I'm wearing a tuxedo t-shirt like Bowser on Sha-na-na.
You are pure class.
Yes, I am.
Elevating every occasion.
It is party in front and business somewhere. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, Lisa.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
That would explain the shadow.
Yeah.
No, hey. So we have 3 trailers to discuss today, and then we are going to launch into our critique of Oscar movies.
Well, because
we're nothing if not topical.
And certainly it's really great to do a trailer podcast in January, the crappiest month for movies.
It is, yeah.
Because everyone has released their prestige pictures in December, and their big tentpole blockbuster features in late November, early December, or on Christmas Day. And then
this
you
is
don't
just
start,
the embarrassing stuff.
Yeah, you don't start seeing movies again until...
March.
April, really,
March
at this point.
Yeah.
Although, I do want to point out, Silence of the Lambs came out in, like, February.
I remember.
And that ended up winning the Oscar, and that was a surprise to everyone because it was basically let us just release this under cover of night. It is a movie from this pulpy crap novel.
A sensible woman and a sensible Bob is going to go talk to a man who loves beans for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. It is a sequel to that movie with William Peterson
and his mumbly wife. I think the thing that remains indelible about that movie for me is not Brian Cox's surprisingly...
We're gentle. Talking about Manhunter now, yes. And not Silence of the Lambs,
not Brian Cox's surprisingly gentle performance, mm-hmm. as Hannibal Lecter. Not William Peterson looking surprisingly angry, because you have to admit, like, through however many seasons of CSI, he looked irritated to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the show that made him a gajillionaire, he's like, oh, God,
angry
this.
To be alive.
Yeah. But the thing
the I... The real crime is whoever cast him in that show. Am I right, William Peterson?
No. But I feel like the thing you have to remember from Red Dragon is that William Peterson's character was married to the most mumbly woman alive. Like, literally, in every scene, it was like someone took that poor actress... turned her upside down, sprayed her with Aquanet because it was the 80s and you had to have the wall of hair, and then shoved a bowl of applesauce in her mouth and said, now do your lines. It was just awful. And to this day, it's just... And then William Peterson looks off in the middle distance and, I have to get inside his head. No, honey, go back to sleep.
Brian Cox was the better Hannibal Lecter.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a more solo performance.
Yeah. Take that, Anthony Hopkins.
Look, he's a fine actor.
Oscar winner.
He's a fine actor, but I think that his performance actually did a lot of damage to subsequent movies because he laid down the framework for every single, you know, cultured yet savage killer.
Well, yeah.
And urbane yet hideous vampire or what have you. It was. There have been a lot of Hannibal Lecter-like characters.
I will give the listener an insight into our life. One of your leading complaints about these kind of movies now with the serial killer is that the serial killer is just an immaculate time manager who has lots of hobbies and lots of interests.
If you have that much going on in your life, you don't need to slice up people.
You don't need to be a serial killer if you have a mastery of architecture.
Like, you should be. I know. Well, remember when I went to go see, it was that movie, Is This Horse Mine? With Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
And The Cell. Was it. And
Viggo Mortensen, I believe.
No, not Viggo Mortensen.
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Vincent D'Onofrio.
They are interchangeable in my mind, which is odd because they look nothing alike.
Can you imagine?
Not really the least bit alike, do they look.
The Lord of the Rings movies would have been so different.
His head would have been tilted in every scene.
I'm just imagining, like, an entire company of dwarves slowly, like, listening to a 45-degree angle to keep up. Anyway, the point is, I went to go see The Cell, and one of the things that just drove me around the bend with it was this guy had managed to put together, like, this soundproof plexiglass cell with working water so that the woman could be drowned inside the cell. And, of course, it was inside a basement, and yet he manages to do this without anyone noticing, and he sets up elaborate traps and this and that and all the other, and I just kept thinking, you could be a contractor. You could be making a lot of money doing luxury bathrooms, and you would still get to torture people. Oh, they pay you to do it.
Yeah.
They, you could say, I'm sorry that terrazzo tile's not available, and like watch a woman weep for 15 minutes while she realizes it's going to be there 2 weeks before she showers.
And that could be how he gets off on the pain, by telling them that the tile is delayed. Either that, or that there are cost overruns.
Or like he puts in a brass fixture instead of satin nickel, and then they're, ah!
You're a monster! I am. I've stared into the abyss and become a very evil contractor.
I've stared into the abyss and seen subway tile.
Yeah.
So, I just don't understand why all of these serial killers are, again, impeccable time managers, and they have rigorous prioritization, and they're all, like, super great with wordplay, and they all have, like, PhDs in cultural studies, so they can put together, like, murals with clues, mm-hmm. or they can make elaborate dioramas where if you recite the first 5 lines of the preamble to the Constitution, all of a sudden it makes sense to find the submerged basement where the spa bathroom is slowly being filled with gas, and it's just bananas. It makes no sense. Literally nobody devotes that much time. Like, Civil War reconstructionists don't devote that much time to their hobby. You're talking about people who, like, weave their own butternut dyed broad gloom before they go out to pretend to kill Johnny Reb or whatever. So, it's just no. I reject the serial killer thing categorically.
So we're about 6 minutes into this podcast.
We have yet to talk
about the trailer. We are the most off-brand podcast in the Incomparable Network.
Well, we bring
Robot or Not Robot, they talk about Robot or Not Robot.
Uh-huh.
The Total Party Kill, they play their little dice game and have a good time.
Oh, they killed parties in that.
Yeah, well.
I thought the podcast was literally them going to parties.
Yeah, who's the real party killer here? It's nerds.
It's me.
Yeah, and, you know, the book podcast, they talk about the books.
And
here we are, literally. Our only purpose is to talk about movie trailers, and we have talked about The Ring and Silence of the Lambs.
No, we've talked about The Lord of the Rings, not The Ring. Viggo
Mortensen. Oh, right.
Yes, because again. Vincent D'Onofrio was in The Ring. Imagine him with a long black wig crawling out of a bathtub.
Yeah, I'm easily confused.
Yeah, you are.
I really haven't studied Vincent D'Onofrio's career.
So, since you're easily confused, should we start off by talking about the Chris Nolan trailer that we watched?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. A director I think you like more than me.
I do. It's true.
Because you've seen The Prestige, which I have not.
Multiple times, yes.
I've seen all three of the Batman movies declining order of enjoyment.
Yeah.
And then
we saw Inception together.
And we saw Inception, which I kind of like, but I thought had many cheats. Many cheats and...
Well, his
and I saw Interstellar on a plane with the sound off, and I found
which is
it
how
much
you
more.
Should see it, really.
I found it much more enjoyable to fill in my own dialogue.
Yeah, that's my biggest complaint about Nolan films is he doesn't have an ear for dialogue, and that's kind of okay because he does a nicely propulsive little whodunit type thing where there's always a little bit of a twist. It's not as bad as the M. Night twist, but there's always a little bit of a. That's what's going on. However,
his twists are actually in service of the story.
Yeah, but no, you don't go into one of his movies and come out quoting chunks of dialogue. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So this is Dunkirk. It's a World War II movie.
Very much so. Very much so. A World War II movie.
It does actually. We did see We did see Nolan's Lucky Charm, Cillian Murphy in it. So you know that's.
It's a very famous battle in World War II. I don't know. I wouldn't presume to know how much American audiences are familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Brit, you are very familiar with Dunkirk.
Well, it was the civilian evacuation. Wasn't it?
This was this was when the Nazis were riding high, unlike today, and
I can't imagine what it would have been like to live in a time of Nazis surging in the public imagination.
Who knew? And they had basically pushed the British and French forces to the French coast, and they were pinned in at Dunkirk. And this is the 500-yard view of Dunkirk. So I apologize if I'm
so basically. Long story short, the Germans were to Brits as gun it was to fish. And barrel,
a bunch of
British people said, "Not today, Hitler."
Yeah,
and they hopped in their tiny fishing dinghies and their other not made for warcraft type watercraft.
Yeah,
and like said, "All right, boys, come."
Civilian force evacuated at Dunkirk, and what should have been a humiliating retreat was actually a rallying.
Because what moment. It showed, it gave people a model of here's how you can rise to the occasion.
Exactly.
You don't have to feel helpless, and this is what you can do to take back your country and to show your country that you're with them.
We probably should have done a whole spoiler alert for the battle that was fought.
70 years ago?
Yeah, well,
really,
sure.
Phil? We're going to do spoilers for history now?
Yeah, spoilers for history. Anyhow, it turned out
alternate
okay.
Alternate spoilers, Phil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's Dunkirk. It's, you know, I'm surprised it's taken people this long to actually do a Dunkirk movie.
Well, because if you do it badly,
yeah,
it would be awful.
Yeah.
That said, we watched both the trailers.
Yeah, there are
and
two.
The first one is really haunting, mm-hmm. and because the first one just shows you a mass of very young men who are effectively penned in, and then you have a quick shot of a row of bodies on a long gray beach, and then you see the men again, and you hear the ominous whine of aircraft overhead, and then the movie cuts. And when I saw that trailer first time, I saw it in the theaters right before I went to see Star Wars Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, talk about a beautiful marriage of trailer to movie.
Yeah,
Like, that just put me right in the headspace that I needed to be for watching Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, of course, is a little bit more involved because it's twice as long and it's no longer just really haunting imagery. It effectively sketches the bare bones story of Dunkirk. It shows you Cillian Murphy, so you're like, oh, look, he's back with Christopher Nolan. Like, he's been in darn near every movie. You get, like, a shot of Harry Styles underwater because I guess they're assuming that every 15-year-old girl in England is going to go see the movie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, probably will. And it looks...
That's Kenneth Branagh, if I'm not mistaken.
And the thing that I really liked about this movie is the... One of the things, and I realize you and I have had talked about the Batman thing before, but one of the things I really like about The Prestige is he does offer a nice and a fine and thoughtful meditation on what it means to decide to take a human life. Mm-hmm. And I have faith that with this movie, he's going to offer a meditation on what it's like to live with the specter of death and the reality of being killed by a stranger every day. And that intimation of mortality and the question as to why you put your life on the line, I tend to connect with those kind of war movies far, far better than the ones where you see some dude with pecs spraying a gun around and screaming, patriotism, yes! Liberty, yes! And where they valorize battle and they imply that it's always morally righteous to go off killing somebody who happens to be on a different side.
So, I don't want to get too excited about the movie because life is full of disappointments.
Yeah. No, I have faith in this director,
though. But he's a good director, and the sense I got when watching the trailers, especially the first one, and this is an odd comparison to make because it felt a lot like Das Boot to me.
Which is one of our favorite war movies.
Which is a great war movie, because Das Boot really, one of its selling points is that it's so confined, and you have these people trapped in the submarine. My favorite scene in Das Boot, in fact, is when they're under attack and they begin to sink down below the pressure that the boat can hold, and the bolts from the sub are actually begin to ping through the submarine.
And
like
there was
bullets.
A scene in the second trailer we saw that was actually a little reminiscent of that, and where they're hunkered down in they're hunkered down the hull of the boat.
And for a movie where they're out in a city and not in open space, and yet it feels so claustrophobic.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That is very exciting to me as a viewer. I think that and I have a confidence in Christopher Nolan that he's going to be able to carry that through.
Yeah. No, I think a good war movie, to be honest, I think a good war movie isn't one where you have epic set pieces. I think it's one where you point out that sometimes the most profound terror you're going to feel is in a really intimate space.
Yeah.
A really small space where your options to get out, if you have any, they're all bad.
Yeah.
Because we watched the movie... I don't know if you actually watched it with me. It's a movie about a sniper duel.
Uh-huh.
Kate Winslet is in it, and...
is this the Ed Harris one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did not see that one.
Yeah, no, that's a
great story. That's the Battle of Stalingrad.
Yeah, Battle of Stalingrad.
Stalingrad or Leningrad? Stalingrad, I want to say. Petersburg.
What I remember most from that movie... Uh-huh. Obviously not the title of it, because I haven't mentioned that yet. But what I remember the most... But what I remember the most from that movie is how much of it takes place with people crammed into windows or doorways and trying to get a very narrow lookout. And, you know, when you and I watched The Hurt Locker, I thought the most effective scenes were the ones where, what was the name of the character?
I don't know. Jeremy Renner.
Okay,
Jeremy
Private Renner. We're Private Jeremy Renner. Corporal Jeremy Renner. I don't know. Was he NCO or is, anyway.
It was a documentary about Jeremy Renner's service, to which we're all grateful for.
Freedom fighter Jeremy Renner.
Yeah.
I want a Photoshop of that so badly now. Anyway, the point is, some of my favorite segments were the ones where you see him running up or down a hall.
Yeah.
Even though you're supposed to be like, oh my god, he's in a moon suit pulling out bombs, and the scary thing is he's in the suit, and he could be blown up like Guy Pearce. No, for me, the most confining things were if he was in a market, or there's a really brutal scene where he and Anthony Mackie wrestle their way across a barrack, and the way that's shot is it shows how they're grappling, and there's not a whole, they're not giving each other any quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the claustrophobia of war to be a much more effective thing than behold this expanse of the Pacific.
Well,
have
I got a movie for you then?
Mm.
Paths of Glory, which is a Stanley Kubrick movie.
Oh yeah.
Oh man, and it is the Stanley Kubrick movie. No, it's Kirk Douglas.
We talked about my Kubrick thing.
Yeah, we have.
On this podcast?
I'm sure that we have. I don't know that we have.
No.
So share your Kubrick thing.
His sound direction drives me bananas.
Well, this would really drive you bananas.
I can't handle his movies because and I don't know if this is deliberate or...
Quite.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because his...
It's meant to unsettle you.
Well, it's so profoundly inorganic, it takes me right out of the story.
Mm.
I mean, I actually get more out of his movies when I watch them on mute, because then I can appreciate the composition and the direction and what acting he allows people in his movies to do. Mm. But the minute you put the sound on, I am just... something in my monkey brain is like, get out! So...
Okay. Well, this one is World War One.
Oh, that's a pretty undercovered...
It's very undercovered in cinema.
Yeah.
Which is
baffling because it's an amazingly barbaric war.
Well, and this is an amazingly barbaric
Trench
movie.
Trench warfare is as confined as it gets.
Well, let me tell you. Uh-huh. You're telling the story of the movie that you've never seen.
Yeah.
Kirk Douglas, he's the commander.
Oh, Jesus.
Of the French forces. Come on, mes amis, we're going to invade Germany. Yeah. And he's basically given this impossible task. It's going to be, everyone knows at the beginning this is a dog of a mission.
Yeah.
So, but they go through with it, and it's a disaster. And he's basically told, you've got to scapegoat three guys. And the second half of the movie is Kirk Douglas, who in civilian life is a lawyer, says, well, I'm going to defend these three men. And
that I scapegoated.
That you've ordered me to scapegoat. And, of course, it's a show trial, and they are summarily...
executed.
Yeah, spoiler alert, it doesn't work out well for anyone involved. But the first half of the movie with the trench warfare, it is
harrowing.
Savagely claustrophobic.
Yeah.
So again, I'm hoping that Dunkirk can capture the spirit of Paths of Glory, Das Boot, and some of the other war pictures we like. The original All's Quiet on the Western Front, with the 1930s was that? That's a good one.
Yeah.
So those are.
So yeah, feeling
good so I'm optimistic about that one.
So feeling good about Dunkirk.
Yep.
And the second trailer we wanted to discuss was Trainspotting, the sequel.
Yeah.
So here's a little known fact about Philip Michaels.
Never have seen Trainspotting.
Mm-hmm.
What year did that come out?
96.
I don't know what I was doing.
You were living in Temecula, I thought.
That was my transition year between Temecula and Los Angeles.
Oh,
so
you were in transit. To be fair, you had luck.
I had some things going on. I had a career switch that year.
Yeah.
So I did not see that movie and have not subsequently seen it. So as we were watching Trainspotting 2, it's all, who is this guy again?
Mm.
It's Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan is here.
Mm-hmm.
It's the girl from Brave.
So
she's around. I didn't know she was into heroin. They really left that out of Brave.
That's the darkest Pixar movie yet.
That is really a dark Pixar movie. Chasing the Dragon by Pixar.
Oh my god. So who voices heroin in that movie?
I don't know. I guess it would be...
You'd have to get... See, the problem is you can't hire an actual heroin addict for the job because they just wouldn't come up to Pixar's standards. I think
it would be Ricky Gervais. It would be Ricky Gervais as the voice of heroin.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm heroin-like. You know,
I'm going to relax you now.
Yeah. gotta chase me, okay?
I'm the dragon.
Yep, you have overdosed. You've ruined it. It's done. Mm. And I guess, like, Wanda Sykes would be the voice of methadone. Oh, God, forgive me. This is actually an excellent picture. And if any of you bastards out there listening to this make this into a movie, I want my cut.
Oh, my God.
Not a big cut, just my taste.
Wanda Sykes is...
Phil's got to wet his beak a little bit.
Or one of the other, or one of the agonist receptors, where she's like, you're not getting into the dopamine receptors today. Yeah. Oh, that's delightful.
Anyhow, Ricky Gervais and Wanda Sykes and heroin, the movie.
So to get back to, I saw Trainspotting.
Yeah, you saw Trainspotting.
I've seen it several times.
You've spotted Trainspotting.
Yes, I saw it in the theater. Mm-hmm. I saw it in the theater literally 5 days after I moved to San Francisco. And, So if you have a movie about a bunch of young people who feel profoundly alienated from culture and literally have no idea how to interact with other human beings...
It rang some bells, huh?
Oh,
some boxes?
Well, I didn't take heroin afterwards or anything.
Really? Because I thought that was part of the promotion. Like, check under your seat, everyone! There's a surprise!
No, I watched Sid and Nancy a lot. I knew it could happen. Okay.
I'm gonna dance with now that wizards. Well,
it was the right movie at the right time, as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, because it was something I was like, oh, look, it's I can externalize my feelings because I'm watching this. And then when I watched the movie in subsequent viewings,
how does it hold up?
So here's what holds up. There's a nice heist at the end of the first one, and there's a lot of jittery, malicious energy in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, for years, I couldn't watch anything with Robert...
Carlyle.
The dude who plays Begbie, because, I mean, he is just the devil incarnate in that movie. And, again, it took me years to shake that. So there's a heist scene that's really great, because it has a jittery, malicious energy. And I like Ewan McGregor's acting throughout. It's convincing. He does a great job of showing you the incredible poison somebody can inject another person's life if they are the type of person who is charismatic yet completely lacking any sort of inner direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that a lot. That said, some of the stuff doesn't hold up. Like, oh, there's the one guy who tries smack and becomes the worst case scenario. And
A little bit of after school special then.
There's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of shock for shock's sake, especially with... But, you know, it's a decent adaptation. I read the book. It's a decent adaptation. There's a little bit of shock for shock's sake. But you have to remember, like, in 96, some of this stuff was still fairly... It wasn't as cliched. It was writing the cliches, not acting them out. And it's a really solid cast. I mean, Kevin McKidd was in it. He dies in the movie, so he's not back in the sequel, obviously. But, you know, Johnny Lee Miller is...
Spoiler alert.
Oh, for a 20-something-year-old movie.
Yes!
Yeah, it's a 21-year-old movie.
Anyway, boy, if you do not know anything about World War II or Trainspotting or Paths of Glory, we have ruined your night.
Well, this is a podcast about ruining things.
Yeah, well, we're on brand again.
There we go, see? Always look on the bright.
Look out, Total Party Kill. We're coming for your ass.
But as somebody who watched Trainspotting and watched this, what I was struck, what I'm looking forward to when I go see it, you're not going to see it with me, obviously.
No.
But what I'm looking forward to is seeing how a bunch of middle-aged people look back on the wreckage of their youth and the stories they tell themselves to live with the things that they chose to do and how it's turned out. Because a lot of this movie seems to come off as a bunch of men in their 40s are trying to recapture one last thing before they all start playing the DA who is the boss of the lead in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, seriously. Because at this point, Ewan McGregor's window is closing and he's going to start playing the Michael Caine roles where he's the salty old string puller as opposed to the, you know, the supple young runner-arounder of plazas.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So,
I liked it. I think it's going to be a fun, I think it's going to be a fun nostalgia trip. And, you know, I'm a member of Generation X. Apparently nostalgia is our thing. So.
Yeah, well, maybe at some point I'll actually watch the first one.
Yeah.
If it's on cable.
Yeah, I don't, it used to be, I don't know who owns the rights to it. Yeah. So we'll have to look that up.
Okay.
Anywho, that's that. And there was the third trailer where my computer actually shut down in protest twice. It shut down in protest twice when we watched it.
Yes.
And that would be the trailer for Logan.
Logan.
Escort to Johnny Cash singing Hurt by 9 Inch Nails.
Yeah, that was in the first trailer. That was the one where your computer said, no.
Twice.
Yeah, and then there's a second trailer where it's a bluesy thing.
Oh, it's something that was on the last season of Sons of Anarchy. Yeah. I can't. But now the problem is the Sons of Anarchy soundtracks have like, if it's been on Sons of Anarchy, I can't listen to it anywhere else because I'm just like.
Now I hope there's a third trailer where it's a choir of children singing the University of Michigan fight song while Wolverine does battles with people. Hail to the victors valiant, hail to the conquering heroes, hail to Michigan.
See, I'm glad you sang it.
The champions of the West.
I'm glad you sang that because I was about to start.
Hail to the.
I was about to start singing On Wisconsin, and I was like, no, wait, wrong state.
Yeah. Totally different. Totally different.
Midwestern and I apologize. And I apologize to any Michigan alumni out there because
don't apologize.
Well, I understand being mixed up with Wisconsin is like a blood insult for them. I don't want to alienate them.
You know, anyway, they have a lot to answer for. Anyway, we saw
the Wolverine trailers, and they have finally decided to acknowledge that Hugh Jackman is in fact not immortal and does age.
Oh man, it is like they. Between him and Patrick Stewart, that movie is like the Sunshine Boys of superhero movies.
Well, the thing is, I actually find Hugh Jackman as Wolverine to be one of the most deeply depressing developments in cinema.
Go on.
All right, in the first X-Men movie, which is just an enjoyable mess.
This is original X-Men, Brian Singer.
Yeah, it is like
I like that one.
It is like the funeral potatoes of X-Men movies.
Yeah,
where like separately a lot of the ingredients are kind of questionable, but you put them all together and it's really fun.
That was an enjoyable motion picture.
Yeah, and in that one, remember Hugh Jackman was basically, oh, it's a dude who came out of Australia, and theater snobs were like, you know, he was Curly in the London revival of Oklahoma, and we're like, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but the point is like there he's young and virile and charismatic and kind of wiry. And at this point, like, you look at Hugh Jackman whenever he has to make one of these movies, because he's made, like, 12 of them by this point.
Yeah.
Every time you see him, this is a man who has eaten nothing but, like, cod and chicken breast and broccoli and has to go, like, lift 8 days a week. And his whole life just seems like this grim, joyless, muscly slog to make these terrible movies where he has to go rescue ungrateful people and teach them lessons before he gets shot 8 or 9 times and then talks about how he can't die and there's government forces, and it's just very sad.
I would like to hear Hugh Jackman as Wolverine do a spoken word version of various Oklahoma songs. Chicks and geese and ducks. Better scurry, bub.
Yeah.
When I get you out of my slurry.
Again, in the early.
With the fringe on top.
Well, this is actually one of the limitations of superhero movies is if you stick with specific icons, you better retire that franchise after a few films, because otherwise you've got people who look long in the tooth.
Well, it's the thing that the James Bond franchise realized.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig's tapping out.
I mean, I kind of enjoy how we've had more Batmans in the last 20 years than Spinal Tap has had drummers. And I also kind of enjoy that Superman gets reinvented every few years for the same reasons. And
we're on like our 20th Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, more Spider-Man than spiders, really. And, you know, I get why Wolverine is charismatic and he's always a cornerstone of the team and he's put butts in seats for years, but oh my god, like, let Hugh Jackman just go sing show tunes for a while. Let the man have some potatoes. It's just, I just feel so sad for him.
That is there's a social media campaign that we need to, or let Hugh Jackman have a fry.
I know!
Let him have some pommes frites.
look, it's eye candy. It's the same thing with the Marvel dudes too. As you see the galaxy of Chris's they have under contract now, yeah. And all of those poor schmoes are busy, you know, getting swole and eating cod, and it's just you know depressing and awful to think about the fact that they have to live their job 24/7 like this. You know, it's awful. So we watched the Wolverine, the Logan trailer.
Logan.
And blah, blah, blah. Things are falling
down.
Well,
it has the violent...
the violent child trope.
The violent child trope. Your favorite thing.
No.
More so than the serial killer who has interesting hobbies.
Well, perhaps the serial killer can raise violent children and write a book about it since they have all that time.
That would be your favorite movie ever.
Oh, and by favorite, I'm like, tell me your secrets. How do you manage your time? Mm-hmm. But anyway, long story short, apparently there's a child in this who is Logan-esque in her ability to fight and go schnicked with the claws. And there's actually a comic series, X-23, where you do have somebody named Laura who is, in fact, a Logan-esque character engineered in a lab. And the great thing about that character was the incredibly complicated relationship she had with the scientist-slash-mother figure in her life. Here, however, they've seemed to have stripped out any and all pesky lady-lady-type interactions, and it's Logan doing what Logan does best, which is mentor extremely young women. And I think that's an interesting thing they chose to do with the character at large. The fact that he seems to like and respect and take teenage girls seriously is something that a lot of comic people benefited from positively as readers growing up. I like seeing it in the movies. And, you know, again, in the first X-Men, I was terribly confused because, like, he's supposed to be all, oh, Jean Grey, oh, Famke Johnson, yet every time Logan was on screen with Rogue, played by the much younger Anna Paquin, like, the sparks were flying off the screen. You're like, oh, this is confusing. Mm-hmm. Oh, this makes me feel icky that I'm rooting for this. So, anyway, here's hoping
it's Woody Allen's Manhattan, only with comic book
figures. It was.
I can extend the claws and heal, but I can't heal my heart. Yeah.
You're Woody Allen is best scene.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. No, it's got my hated violent child trope. I hate the violent child trope. I hate the, oh, they're small and innocent, but capable of wreaking incredible destruction. Yeah. I loathe it. It's cheap. It's easy. It's a shortcut. It's a shortcut the same way that serial killers who also happen to be the first violinist for the Tucson Philharmonic and they're raising a hydroponic farm full of carnivorous plants that they use to slowly kill border crossers.
Let me tell you about Mahler's Ninth Symphony.
They say as they blindly pluck kidneys out of waiting bodies. And my violin children, they're out in the desert too. It's all one big ball of cliche and I hate it. So...
So you're looking forward to it, is what I'm getting.
No, not at all.
No.
Which is a shame because I like
Your movie going experiences are a secret to me. once you grab the chloroform soaked rag each night and press it against my face and I pass out, I don't know what you do. So,
dear listeners, this is a total fiction. If there had been chloroform, I would have used it to sleep train our child, not knock Phil out before going to the movies.
But have you seen the Wolverine pictures?
Yes, I have.
So you've seen Wolverine and the other one, which
was... The Wolverine, and the one where he goes to Japan, yes.
Yes, Wolverine goes to Japan, which sounds like the bad news bears go to Japan.
That was like a bit... So do you remember how in the 80s we were supposed to be terrified of Japan?
Oh, boy.
And Michael Crichton wrote like a whole thriller about it.
Yes, Black Rain or Black...
Red Sun Rising or some nonsense like that. And... Marvel Comics really jumped in where, like, Logan was also a ninja or... No, a samurai.
Yeah,
Logan... There's no way he could be a ninja. Well, like, and here's the thing, is in the comics, he's, like, 5'3" and incredibly hairy and weighs, like, 300 pounds thanks to all the metal on his frame.
Yeah.
So, like, in theory, in the movies, you should have somebody who is built like Derek Waters from Drunk History.
There's a casting decision.
That's how you
Good news, 20th Century Fox! You can keep the series alive!
That's how you reboot it after Hugh Jackman's like, I just want a French fry. But, no, anyway, in the 80s, they, you know, Marvel doubled down on the whole Japan thing with, perhaps we shouldn't be terrified of these people and their assembly lines. We should learn about their culture, and Wolverine is just the vehicle with which we all become culturally diverse.
Yeah, they really gun-hoed the hell out of that. That is a picture that does not hold up well.
Nope.
By the way, Ron Howard's gun-ho.
Oh boy. So yeah. So there was that. Honestly, the thing I liked the best about that Logan has adventures on the subway picture is at the very end of it, when he's trying to go through security at TSA, he runs into Sir Patrick Stewart, who gets him through with a little bit of mind wankery, and that was my favorite part of the film.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so you like the Wolverine pictures?
Look, I watch a lot of movies I don't necessarily like.
Okay. So they were a pleasant obligation?
So the one that has Liam Neeson and Ryan Reynolds in it, the original Wolverine spinoff one. Liev Schreiber, that's right.
Not Liam Neeson.
Oh, God.
Oh, man, we found your Viggo Mortensen, Vincent D'Onofrio. Mix them up.
All of a sudden, I really want to see the movie where Liev Schreiber gets on the phone and says,
I have a particular set of skills. Most of which are narrating HBO sports documentaries.
Yes, that's how it's going. You stepped on the
show. Sorry.
No, Liev Schreiber is quite charismatic in the movie, and Ryan Reynolds, I mean, honestly, that movie is what got him Deadpool a decade later, so it worked out well for him.
And got him Green Lantern, too.
So, we've talked about this.
Have we talked about Green Lantern? I thought I had forced it out of my mind.
So
that is not a good news.
Should we apologize to folks that we're now 35 minutes in and we have not talked about the Oscars once and we're about to go on a Green Lantern tangent?
We can go. I don't think you ever have to apologize for a Green Lantern tangent.
Yeah. So first of all, as you all know, we think that it was the wrong Green Lantern movie was made, because what it should have been about is it should have been about Alan Scott, who was the original Green Lantern in the Justice Society of America, and Hal Jordan, and it should have been about those guys getting their butts wiped out in space and forcing Guy Gardner, Kyle Rayner, and Jon Stewart to step up.
Yep.
Because having something where you have three people in over their heads, one of whom is a total jackhole, Guy Gardner. That would be awesome.
Yep.
We would have we even cast that movie at one point.
Our spec script for Lantern Corps, we called the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. We cast The Rock as Kilowog.
I think that's a mistake, because he's so charismatic, you don't want to put him under all the makeup. Mm. But I see your point. We had Bruce Campbell as Guy Gardner at one point. He's too old now.
No, he's far too old now.
But like when we first started talking about it, he would not have been. Then again, when we first started talking about our Green Lantern movie, Paul Newman was still alive and on deck to play Alan Scott, so that should tell you how old, how long we've been having this conversation.
Exactly.
Anyway, look, there were a lot of problems with Green Lantern, least of which being that Ryan Reynolds and women, he had great chemistry.
They had the one villain with the puffy head.
Oh, God, yeah.
Puffy!
Sinestro.
Yeah.
Sinestro.
No. It wasn't Sinestro, because Sinestro was just Sinestro. I forget even the actor who played the part, but basically it was like he got a bee sting and his head had swollen up.
I could have sworn that was Sinestro.
No, that is not.
Oh, Peter Hammond?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hector Hammond with Peter Sarsgaard. Thank you, IMDb, for filling that in.
Look, part of the problem was Hal Jordan and Carol Ferris, you have to believe that's a partnership of equals. And unless you're like, oh, they're equally bland, which they were in this film,
mm-hmm.
You know, it was not a good role for Blake Lively.
No.
And
that is true.
Yeah, and there was way too much CGI type stuff.
Oh yeah.
And the movie, curiously, it was inert. It had no stakes, and it was a dumb origin story. Like, again, I think that the thing about our movie, which will never be made because Paul Newman is obviously dead.
Yeah.
And also, we have no pull whatsoever in Hollywood. But the thing about our movie was it threw you right in the middle, where the premise was you had a Lantern Corps that already knew how to work together, and then a couple people that you're supposed to care about get wiped out in Act One.
Yeah.
And origin stories are boring. Dennis Quaid was originally
brilliant casting decision.
Yeah, he was supposed to be our Hal Jordan. I think right now he could play our Alan Scott because he's now old.
Yeah, he could do it.
Yeah, we could have Ewan McGregor as our Hal Jordan at this point.
It's still alive. It's still there. If you've got the bucks, we've got the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I forgot who we had as Kyle Rayner. But,
I don't recall.
It doesn't matter at this point.
Who cares?
Yeah, he's just some pretty meat stick.
Some handsome lad.
Yeah, somebody who will cheerfully give up the next decade of his life to a potato-free existence.
Exactly.
All right. If I really have to take off my shirt for the scene, the film demands it. Okay.
You get to lick the skirt steak, and that's your dinner tonight, son.
Celery water. So, also, I have to say, out of the DC properties, I do tend to find Green Arrow to be one of the most boring, to be honest with you.
Green Arrow, Green Lantern.
Green Lantern. God, I'm just confusing everything today. Yeah. I'm sorry. No, Green Arrow I love.
Green Arrow is Viggo Mortensen. Green Lantern is Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yes, there you go. Thank you. Okay. Well, we're just casting Vincent D'Onofrio and everything by default at this point.
Well, that's in our follow-up sequel. Meh!
No, next thing you know, he'll be the one on the phone going, I have a very particular set of skills.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So
should we discuss Oscars since that was the
is
original?
And Viggo Mortensen, isn't it?
So, yes, he is.
Yes, as it turns out, Viggo Mortensen was nominated for...
Vincent D'Onofrio snubbed, though.
Yeah.
For whatever things he did this year.
I don't know what he did
so
this year.
So we'll go through this quickly because as I look through the list, as a fellow who doesn't go to movies, and I should explain. As someone who hosts, who is on a movie podcast,
you hate the live movie going experience, though.
I really do.
At this point, you just like watching movies if you can watch them on your couch because you hate people.
I hate going out. I hate people. Yeah. I hate the outside world, and I also I call this the King's Speech phenomenon.
Oh God, we went to see that in the
because
theater.
Went to go see that in the theater.
You're like, we should have just seen this at home. And there's nothing cinematic about it.
There is nothing. This is a really good TV movie.
Yeah.
This is if we were sitting home at night on a Saturday and said, let's turn on HBO and see what's on. Oh, the King's Speech.
Oh, look.
This is enjoyable.
Colin Firth is stammering.
Wasn't it
Colin Firth?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
There are movies you want to see in the theater because they're big and epic in scope and it's a shared experience. Mm-hmm. I think you would say that Arrival, which you saw.
I saw Arrival. I deliberately chose to see Arrival in the theaters because I wanted to see a flipping spaceship on a screen 10 feet tall.
It is one. Yeah. And that's a thing you'd want to see in the theaters. We're looking at the Best Picture nominees right now. La La Land. I wish to see that. And I've had people say, oh, you would like La La Land.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Fences, which I also want to see.
No.
I think I could see. I can wait till that's on cable because that's a play that someone turned into a movie.
If I had any intention of seeing Manchester by the Sea, which I do not.
Yeah.
That's another one you could watch on the TV.
Yeah. Hacksaw Ridge, if I was going to go see that, which I'm not sure that I want to participate in the Mel Gibson redemption arc.
Nope.
That would be you see in the theater.
I'm not watching it.
But all the rest of these, you know, your Lions, your Moonlights, your Hell or High Waters, your Hidden Figures, it's basically, if you see those on your TV at home,
you're fine.
You're good.
Yeah.
You're probably better.
Yeah.
Because you
this year's lineup for the Best Picture slate really doesn't make an argument for going to see movies in theaters.
No,
which is ironic because my suspicion is the reason La La Land got so many nominations is because it's supposed to be a movie that validates the entire movie industry. I feel like it was a safe choice.
Yeah,
and I also feel like boy, howdy, did they miss the mark because the movie that exalts the movie industry this year was the Coen Brothers' Hail Caesar.
Nominated, I think, for one Oscar.
And the thing is, though, Caesar.
You really enjoy. We both enjoy that movie, and I think we've talked about it before. You really haven't. It's one of your favorite Coen Brothers movies. It's one of my top fives for Coen Brothers.
Top three, at least for me.
Yeah.
I go between that and Big Lebowski as number one,
mm-hmm.
and I've already told you my theory about how Hail Caesar and Big Lebowski are just bookends on their Los Angeles meditation, right?
Yeah.
But no, Hail Caesar, it's a beautiful movie. That what they managed to do is they managed to they managed to rip off so many iconic studio system things, and yet the actors who are in the middle of these pastiches managed to make them their own. I will talk for years about the excellent performance Scarlett Johansson turned in, because the minute that you see her battling morning sickness while filming a mermaid spectacle is phenomenal. The acting she does alone, just by twitching the corner of her mouth and squinching her eyes a little bit, is amazing. You're looking at somebody who really put a lot of thought into this performance and did not get showy about it in the slightest. And I thought that it spoke volumes about who this character is and what she has to do. And more importantly, how much artifice was built into the studio system.
Yeah.
And then you see it again in the Channing Tatum stuff, too.
Yeah, sure.
Where, you know, you can read Bert Gurney as... he's a crypto communist in one light, or you can see him as just an idiotic artist who was very easily taken in by a cynical political machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that there's room for both those interpretations. And it's a crime that Hail Caesar got overlooked this year, because it's just such a tight, bright, springy love letter to the power of entertainment as a vehicle for moving people along from point A to point B towards where they want to go. Anyway.
Yes. I'm looking at the Best Actor nominees again. Nothing I've seen. I read Fences. I've read the play.
Yeah. Well, the problem is with a lot of these things is it comes down to who's been crusading, who's been campaigning.
Yeah.
And at this point, you could have seen all these nominees coming, and you can see why every single one of them was nominated. And of course, Emma Stone's going to get nominated. It's because she sang and danced. And of course, Meryl Streep gets nominated because everyone...
She's Meryl Streep.
Yeah, at this point. What I have really enjoyed this award season is seeing Natalie Portman channeling Jackie Onassis on the red carpet everywhere she goes. Like, everyone made fun of Anne Hathaway for being completely thirsty her year when she won. But I mean, Jesus Christ, Natalie Portman is not exactly playing this cool this year.
The two people I hope do not win.
Uh-huh.
Natalie Portman, because uh-huh. I heard a clip of her.
Mm-hmm.
Doing Jackie, and it is such a it is such a mannered this is my Oscar clip performance.
Yeah.
The other one is Casey Affleck.
Yeah.
And the reason is because I saw The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
And you were never going to...
Oh my God, that has ruined Casey Affleck for me for life.
Yeah.
Because he is... And I guess it's what he was aiming for in this movie, but he is such a wormy little nobody in that movie.
Yeah.
That it has... I just find him unpleasant to look at in everything he does now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and plus there's also his off-screen behavior, which, let's be frank, if he had been, say, associated with Birth of a Nation, we wouldn't be seeing him up here.
No.
So there's some really ugly political stuff with his presence that makes me even more disinclined to take these awards seriously.
Mm-hmm.
That said, Mahershala Ali
is
fantastic on Luke Cage and Netflix, and I am thrilled to see him get a nomination for Best Actor in a Supporting Role.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand Moonlight is a brilliant and devastating film, which, again, we'll probably watch on cable because I hate crying in public.
Yep.
And I love Michael Shannon. I don't know if you've seen him in anything.
I don't think I have.
I may make you watch The Iceman Comes With Me. It's about he plays a contract killer in New Jersey.
Okay.
And he's very good in it. And that was when I jumped on the plane. And he had the thankless job of being the villain in Zack Snyder's...
Oh, he's General Zod.
Yeah, he is.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed him as that, too.
Well, who cares?
Wow.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
No,
laying my cards on the table here. Zack Snyder movies don't really...
My point is, I'm not going to make you watch Superman. I love you. I want to do that to you. But my point is if he can put in good work in that polished turd, then imagine what he can do when he's in something that actually is not bad. And then we get to actresses in the supporting role, and honestly, I'm just here for Viola Davis.
Well, yeah, I think that there's a little bit of gamesmanship here.
Yeah.
To get her into that category as opposed to Best Lead Actress, because you could make the case that she should have been in that category.
And frankly, I don't doubt that Michelle Williams did her usual stellar...
Excuse me, I'm choking here. No, we're good.
I don't doubt that Michelle Williams did her usual stellar work. I mean, she's quite a gifted actress, or gifted thespian, really.
Yeah.
We should actually stop using the gender-specific things.
When I took acting, my acting teacher was, actress is a Hollywood term.
Yeah.
Da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
But my point is, at this point, I feel like she's almost like Meryl Streep, where she just keeps getting nominated, and... Yeah. I'm like, do you nominate her because you want to see what she'll wear? Are you hoping she'll bring the embalmed corpse of Heath Ledger on the carpet with you? Like, what is what?
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I used to also cynically, like, there's a whole lot, oh, Amy Adams got passed over this year. And look, she put in a very good performance. But that movie was...
Arrival, you're talking about.
Yeah. But, you know, Arrival was ultimately... It was not a movie about actorly performances so much as it was a movie about ideas and an actor's ability to successfully convey them. And, yeah.
I thought they were going to nominate her because she's also apparently quite good in Nocturnal Animals.
Yeah.
And I thought it was going to be one of those Kevin Spacey type situations where he was in Usual Suspects and Seven in the same year, and they go out. Kevin Spacey, great performances in lots of movies. So here's your award.
Yeah. So you thought she'd get one, and
plus,
plus by the calculus of whatever she's quote unquote due.
Yeah.
But I don't know. She and Michelle Williams are kind of like the Kate Winslet now, where Winslet got nominated tons of times before she finally won, and she won for.
Like one of her most middling performances.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, at this point, Kate Winslet does good work whenever she does, but some of her best performances were when she was much younger.
Yeah.
When she was still like, ah! Like, completely off the chain.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, you know, I suspect Viola Davis is probably going to get it. Possibly Octavia Spencer.
No, it's going to be Viola Davis.
Yeah. But
it's always a great award show when someone who has seen none of the movies can probably accurately predict the winners. Hey, it's animated feature film. I've seen two of the five nominees.
Because you have a kindergarten.
Because I have a child. Yeah. I would go for Moana over Zootopia.
Yeah.
Zootopia apparently is the favorite. If you believe the various prediction sites.
My suspicion is that Moana will win on music.
Hmm.
And it gets the cinematography, again, having seen none of these. I love the costume design category. I really do. But
I'm scanning down to the writing ones, which naturally are towards the bottom
of the
list.
Well, no one cares about writers.
No.
So, but yeah, like I said, How Far I'll Go is the one that got nominated for Moana, which is the ballad, and they can bring out the adorable 14-year-old. But I really feel like the Oscars have an opportunity to just spike their profile on social media and BuzzFeed and all the rest if they have The Rock come out and sing You're Welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you don't expect Dwayne Johnson to be able to carry a team. And he did all right, and mm-hmm. it was a fun song. It was the one that our daughter immediately picked up on.
So how do you feel about the writing awards? How do you feel about the adaptation of Arrival?
I think it was brilliant.
Yeah.
I do. And I say this as somebody who really loves Ted Chiang.
Mm-hmm.
I had been really curious as to how they would adapt.
Turn that into a feature-length movie.
And he did wonderfully.
Yeah.
And I love the framing device around it. And I loved, again... I love this is a movie that exalts discovery. This is a movie where there is a profound respect for the slow and patient and tedious work of trying to solve a very difficult puzzle under very difficult circumstances, and points out that there are some people who thrive on discovery for the sheer sake of knowing something about the world. It is a movie that has a tremendous amount of respect for the scientific process and a tremendous amount of respect for the notion that one of the most noble things we can do as a species is learn more about the universe that we live in and how to negotiate it with grace and goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved how this movie was put together, and even the science fiction-y stuff that was originally the hook in the book, or I should say in the story, it's present, it's done very faithfully. Amy Adams sells the hell out of whatever she has to sell, but again, this the adaptation really focuses instead on the sheer delight of being able to use your brain to understand the world around you and help make it a better place.
Hmm. Yeah, having seen none of the other pictures.
Yeah. It was the thing that I found a little jarring about the movie is it feels like it was written for a country that doesn't exist, if that makes sense. Because it's a movie that unabashedly celebrates the notion of knowledge as a means to engineer, knowledge as a means to midwife social progress. And that's an idea that, again, it's put forth very much in the movie, and it's one where you walk out of the theater and the disconnect between the experience you just had in the theater and, say, your Twitter timeline is really sharp.
Mm.
So, you know, that was the one thing I found jarring, but that's not the fault of the movie.
No.
It's just the moment in history where it happened to land.
Yeah.
But that said, I loved Arrival. I loved it a whole lot. And, okay. I thought the adaptation was great. I've heard really great things about The Lobster.
I have as well.
Yeah.
Of the movies that are nominated for a lot of things that I'd like to see when they eventually find their way
onto my television. I want to see Hell or High Water.
I want to see Hell or High Water. I want to see The Lobster. I want to see...
Also, Taylor Sheridan is somebody to watch out for. He was the guy who got himself killed off on Sons of Anarchy in Season 3 so he could follow his writing and directing muse.
I want to see Fences. I will probably go and see La La Land in the theater.
Yeah.
Because that seems like my kind of picture.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's the best picture or what have you.
It's going to get best picture,
It's going to get best picture.
You know why it's going to get best picture?
Because it's about show people.
And it's not political.
Yeah.
It's not political, and the Academy is terrified of doing another Crash.
Yeah, exactly.
So they'll be like, well, we don't want to appear elitist or out of touch, and this is all, you know, Emma Stone looks great in a dress, and people love that Ryan Gosling because they make pictures about him saying, girl, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
And Captain Fantastic, I think I'll probably seek out.
Yeah.
The Viggo Mortensen or Vincent D'Onofrio picture. Yeah. I forget which.
It could be either one. They're so much alike.
Yeah. I think they're both in that, actually, in a dual role. Like, halfway through, Vincent D'Onofrio taps in.
You know, I loved it when Terry Gilliam did that. And, no, it was, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie, where Heath Ledger was his lead.
Oh, right. Brothers Grimm or
no,
the...
No, no.
Well...
We're going to look it up now.
And there was that Bob Dylan movie where he's played by, like, 20,000 people, most of whom are Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
I'm not there.
Oh, it's The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Okay, sure.
And, yeah, Heath Ledger, if I remember the story correctly, Heath Ledger died.
During film.
And I remember I watched the film either on our way to London or back.
Yes,
and,
I remember.
What I remember was...
That was on the flight that I watched The Dark Knight, which is really how that movie is meant to be seen.
But my point I was getting to is that Terry Gilliam, and again, the movie is kind of an incoherent mess in a lot of ways.
Really? A Terry Gilliam movie is incoherent?
It cost me a lot to admit this, Philip. Don't you dare. But, but what I really liked was the way that he turned the recasting into part of the overall narrative and the surreality of the lead female's experience with this person she was in love with, where his aspect kept shifting as her perception of what was going on and her feelings towards him changed. And it was also deeply respectful to the actors who swapped in, who included Colin Farrell, Johnny Depp, and Jude Law.
Oh.
And they are all used to beautiful effect. Like, this is a guy who knew how to use his actors and actresses to showcase their looks. And I like that. I like a director who appreciates the way his actors and actresses present themselves.
Okay.
So there's that. But yeah, to the best of my knowledge, no one has yet attempted that with Viggo Mortensen and Vincent D'Onofrio.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see it.
Okay. Yeah. We should probably, based on the position of the sun in the sky, we should probably wrap this up.
We want to thank you guys very much for tuning in.
Do we want to do our... We have that normal segment where we talk about stuff that we've watched?
No, because this is an hour long.
Okay.
Well, if you really want to talk about stuff you've watched.
Yes, I want to mention something.
Then you know what we can do? Let's record another podcast.
Film another podcast?
Yes, we should.
A video podcast?
A video cast.
We'll do that.
Yes.
Then people can see how sad I am that I can't do this segment now!
Philip, we've gone 58 minutes.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. So, again, we want to thank you.
Hail to the victors valiant.
We're on a bed with a lot of throw pillows that I can use.
Hail to the conquering heroes. Go on. Wrap it up. I'm trying to play music over your farewell. It's poignant, damn it.
That was Philip Michaels, and I'm Lisa Schmeiser. Thank you so much for listening
to Michigan.
Lisa Ruin, the movies and the football themes of the Middle West.